Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, a follow-up to our segment on Tuesday with feminist writer Eleanor Burkett, who doesn't accept that transgender women are, well, women.
I accept that they do not feel comfortable as men. I accept that they might feel like what they think a woman feels like, but I have no idea how they would know what a woman feels like.
So we'll have a call-in for transgender listeners to describe how your gender feels according to you. But first, welcome to the lily pad era in America's 25 years war in Iraq. The Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Martin Dempsey told reporters yesterday that the U.S. may establish a collection of lily pads. Isn't that a lovely, dainty name for military bases? In its effort to fight back ISIS, President Obama announced the first such lily pad this week, complete with 450 American trainers, at least he didn't call them cute little froggies, to help take back the city of Ramadi, 70 miles from Baghdad. These trainers make up about this makes a total of about 3,500 Americans sent back into Iraq since the complete withdrawal in 2011. Let's see what's going on in America's on-again, off-again, in-again, out-again 25-year-long war in Iraq, with Fred Kaplan, who writes the War Stories column for Slate and is author of the book The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. Hi, Fred. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, thanks. Good to be here.
So what's the difference between these trainers, as the president is calling them, and the ground troops that politicians like Lindsey Graham want to deploy?
Well, at least as it's explained, the trainers are not going to go out to the field and fight. They're going to stay on the base. There are some people in the Senate who want some of these trainers to go out with the troops, if just to identify targets for the airplanes the aerial bombs to hit. But Obama has said pretty adamantly that no, that's not going to happen either. And, you know, even these 400 trainers, Brian, about at least half of them aren't even trainers. These are the people supplying and securing. You know, if you're going to put American troops someplace, you need to have convoys bringing in supplies. You need to have security guards at the gates. Anytime you put, this is how escalation happens. Anytime somebody says, okay, we're going to put 1,000 troops out there, if it's really 1,000 combat troops or 1,000 trainers, count on that number doubling or tripling for the support that you need to make it possible for those people to live out there.
Huh. Meaning that additional number of people, two or three times the 450,
well,
is
no,
like...
I'm told that the 450 include
all of that,
the support and security.
I see. So when I hear the word trainers, when I think of things that I've gone to that are labeled trainings, you know, it's usually a guy in a golf shirt with a PowerPoint.
Yeah. No, the whole thing, quite honestly, it gives me a little pit of nausea in my stomach. I mean, on the one hand, we have seen this movie before, or at least those of us of a certain age have seen this movie before, and the rest of us have read about it. You know, the first troops into Vietnam were trainers, and then there was a slow escalation. Then the trainers went out with the soldiers because, you know, the South Vietnamese soldiers, because they needed to have our experience and discipline on the ground. And then the next thing you know it, well, we know what happened the next thing you know it. And here's the thing. On the one hand, I'm not terribly concerned right now because President Obama knows this history very well. He knows the limits of our interest in this fight, and he also understands the limits of what we can do, even with a lot more troops, if there isn't the political basis for some kind of settlement within Iraq. If the government, the Shiite-led government, cannot attract and earn the loyalty of Sunnis, who currently, many of them, would prefer to go with the Sunni of ISIS soldiers than the persecution that they faced from Shiite government. If that can't be solved, then 10,000, 20,000, 100,000 American troops isn't going to make a damn bit of difference in the long term.
So
what he's doing, he's saying, look, we are still with you. We are committed with you. We're putting an air. We're putting a base closer to you, so we can have faster turnaround on the airstrike. So that maybe we can hand out stuff directly to Sunni militia who are having a hard time reconciling and joining the Iraqi military. But there's only so much that we can do. My worry, the reason why there's a pit gnawing in my stomach, is that. With the possible exception of Rand Paul, whom I'm not nuts about on other grounds, a lot of the people running for president in both parties, I think, would be less resistant to the pressure for serious escalation than President Obama is.
And we're going to play in a few minutes a Scott Walker clip and see how big that pit in your stomach grows and try to read between the lines of a sort of non-answer that he gave on ABC This Week on Sunday. But before we even get to the differences between the Republican presidential hopefuls and President Obama, is there a difference between President Obama and his Joint Chiefs of Staff chairman? Are they on the same page based on what General Dempsey said yesterday? And I'm sure you love military euphemisms as much as I do, and you probably know many more of them. So have you ever heard before of General Dempsey's term lily pads, which he used for a collection of new U.S. military bases in the country that he sees as possible?
Yeah, see, so that, you know, U.S. helicopters and airplanes can just jump from one lily pad to the other. Yeah, that one's been around for a long time. You can't, Dempsey isn't to take the sole rap on that one.
But he seemed to be preparing the reporters on his plane for a future with multiple new military bases that are American.
That's right. You know, here's the thing about military advice, and I'm not putting down the military. The main thing about generals, it's not that, especially these days, it's not that they're flaming war hawks and they just can't wait to get into a battle. But if the president says, okay, I want to accomplish this, you know, I want to defeat ISIS, I want to crush ISIS, I want to contain ISIS, whatever it is, then they become, by nature, very conservative in their planning. What they really don't want is to get involved in a conflict and lose. They're even okay in stretching it out, but they don't want American credibility to go down the tubes by putting in their effort for nothing. And so, as I say, that's why they want to have twice as many or three times as many security and support personnel as there are people involved in military activity. You know, everything is a risk, you know. What do you need to have a 90% chance of success? What do you need to have a 50% chance of success? There are estimates for all of these, and they will go with the 90% or the 95%. So if the president lays out a mission, they will say, okay, here's what my best military expertise says you need. And then the president, whoever he or she is, has a choice. If he thinks that that's way out of line, they can either scale back the mission or, and this is what the military doesn't like, scale back the numbers without doing anything to the mission. That's what they have a problem with. And that was a lot of the nature of the debate over how many troops to add to Afghanistan back in President Obama's first tangle with military calculus in 2009-10.
Right. And President Obama does say one thing consistently, though here we are talking about whether he's going to be sucked in through mission creep to more and more redeployment in Iraq. Last year when he announced the, I guess it was 3,000 roughly, Americans to go back in as advisors, and this week when he announced the additional 450, he does continue to stand by the basic statement that we will not have a massive deployment of American ground troops to get in there and fight a war again. So this is drawing the response that I think you were referring to before, as beginning a gnawing feeling in the pit of your stomach from the Republican presidential hopefuls, other than, I guess, Lindsey Graham, who flat out says, hey, put 10,000 new American ground troops in there. This is our war, too. Let's go in there and fight. I am not your anti-war president. Other than him, the Republicans are mostly calling President Obama too weak for drawing the line at no massive ground invasion without saying they would actually do anything differently than he's doing at the moment. So here is Scott Walker as a prime example of this on ABC This Week on Sunday with Jonathan Carl Walker.
I think we shouldn't rule anything out. I think that's a big mistake this president has made here and elsewhere about saying how long we would go or how much we would invest.
I'm not talking about ruling it out. I'm saying, would you do that?
No, I'm not. I'm not arguing that's the first approach. I'd tell you three specific things I think we should do in Iraq. First, we should reengage the strength of the American forces that are there. Once you do that, you empower our allied forces that are there on behalf of Iraq to reclaim the territory that ISIS has taken. And third, you just need to make sure you do it in a way that doesn't provide safe haven into places like Syria as you push them out.
So you would not send combat troops now to Iraq?
No, I don't. I believe right now we have a capacity to reclaim Iraq with the Iraqi forces are there as long as we unleash the power that's already there of the American armed forces.
And you say you wouldn't rule out anything, though. Does that include, I mean, would you rule out a full-blown U.S. reinvasion of Iraq and Syria?
I don't think we should ever send a message to our foes as to how far we're willing to go.
So you wouldn't rule out a full-blown reinvasion?
I would not rule out boots on the ground.
Do you understand his position?
No, I was just thinking. Look, this is what these people feel they have to do in the election, okay? You know, they want to sound strong, the whole rap against Obama, you know, he's weakening America all around the world, you know. But they also know that 75-80% of the American public doesn't want to read another report about American battle casualties in Iraq. So we need to reengage the strength of our
personnel. Step number one.
Yeah, that doesn't
you're a military reporter. Maybe you can translate into English. Reengage.
Well, talking Romanian. I have no idea what that
means. Reengage the strength of the American forces in Iraq. And again, he came back to it later in the answer when he said, as long as we unleash the power of the American forces currently in Iraq. Give them guns instead of training suits?
Yeah, I guess, you know, wake them up. They're taking an afternoon nap. Have them looking with great determination. I think one candidate, I forget who, said that he would do pretty much the same thing that Obama's doing facing off Russians in Ukraine, but with greater resolution. You know, that's the danger, you see. A lot of these people don't know what they're talking about. Quite honestly, in their political careers to date, they haven't had any reason. You know, what does the governor of Wisconsin need to know? You know, is he going to invade Minnesota sometime soon? He doesn't need to know any of this stuff. So what does he do? He gets himself wrapped up with the traditional litany of Republican, usually neocon military advisors. And by the way, I don't mean to exclude Hillary Clinton from this either. I mean, in the various debates within the Obama administration when she was Secretary of State, there was almost never an inch of space between her position and that of the generals. I'm a little worried about her, too, quite frankly.
But the generals were prescribing specific things at specific times, like the troop surge into Afghanistan.
Yeah, like 40,000 instead of, you know, 10, 20, or 30. And
that's different than reengage the strength of the American forces,
again,
as long as we don't.
I don't know what that means.
You know, but I'm going to play this. I'm going to play that clip again, because this represents the state of the Republican presidential campaign. And Scott Walker at the moment is the leading candidate. So let's listen to 1 minute of what Governor Walker would do about Iraq as he was in conversation on ABC This Week.
No, I think we shouldn't rule anything out. I think that's a big mistake this president has made here and elsewhere about saying how long we would go or how much we would invest.
I'm not talking about ruling it out. I'm saying, would you do that?
No, I'm not arguing that's the first approach. I'd tell you three specific things I think we should do in Iraq. First, We should re-engage the strength of the American forces that are there. Once you do that, you empower our allied, the allied forces that are there on behalf of Iraq to reclaim the territory that ISIS has taken. And third, you just need to make sure you do it in a way that doesn't provide safe haven in the places like Syria as you push them out.
So you would not send combat troops now to Iraq?
No, I don't. I believe right now we have a capacity to reclaim Iraq with the Iraqi forces are there as long as we unleash the power that's already there of the American armed forces.
And you say you wouldn't rule out anything, though. Does that include, I mean, would you rule out a full-blown U.S. reinvasion of Iraq and Syria?
I don't think we should ever send a message to our foes as to how far we're willing to go.
So you wouldn't rule out a full-blown reinvasion?
I would not rule out boots on the ground.
Scott Walker with ABC's Jonathan Carl. The third one there was, because he said he had 3 points. And the first one we discussed, re-engage the strength of the American forces in Iraq, whatever that means. The third one was, as long as we don't allow ISIS to create safe havens in Syria. Well,
so I guess we're going into Syria more deeply, too.
I guess these same number of American forces, small number that we would unleash the power of, would chase them into Syria and be able to vanquish them there.
Yeah. You know, I think we've talked about this before, Brian. I once had a graduate school professor who talked about the fallacy of small-scale maps. You know, let's say you're Scott Walker and you're looking at a map of the Middle East in a book, and you see that Iraq and Syria, these places just seem so small. I mean, you know, there are people who have serious jobs who think that just bombing the bejesus out of some place, oh, that'll stop them. You know, ignoring that these people, ISIS people, that they're mixing with the normal people on the ground. It's very hard to bomb an ISIS guy who's living in this apartment without killing a lot of people in the next apartment. They seem not to realize this. They seem to think that, you know, it's like a game of Risk where, you know, you put a marker on a grid on a map and therefore you have retaken that position. This is one problem. I mean, I'm not saying that military people think like this, but often what happens when new presidents come into office, especially if they feel pressured to do something hawkish or serious or more aggressive, they think that the military holds the key to all wisdom, and they don't. They hold, again, their wisdom is, look, you tell me what you want to do, and I'm going to give you a very conservative appraisal of what it will take for me to do my part of it. In the case of the current mess all over the Middle East, including Iraq and Syria, the military is only one piece of this problem. It's largely a political issue. The military can do certain things to hold the line. This notion that people like General Keane and Lindsey Graham are putting, we need to put 10, 20,000 more troops, they're refighting the last war, which, you know, we are not going to fight again. This isn't going to happen. It usually takes presidents a while. It took President Obama a while. It took President John Kennedy a while to realize, okay, the military is a tool in a specialized toolbox. That's not the key issue. I've got to think through. Every time that there is pressure for military escalation, a president and people in Congress, too, should first answer the question, okay, what is the U.S. interest in this place? What can the U.S. accomplish, even if there were no restrictions, and then gauge what an appropriate response is in light of those two primary questions. What too often happens is that the military question, you know, how many do we need, takes precedence, and the real crucial questions, which are actually a lot harder to address.
Right. And your article
tend to fall by the wayside.
And my guest is Fred Kaplan, military correspondent for Slate and author of the book David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. And we can take your phone calls on this, too. Do you stand with Scott? Listeners, Scott Walker, do you stand with Lindsey Graham, send in those 10 or 20,000 more troops and let's have this fight again. And even that will be enough because we had many more tens of thousands in Iraq before the withdrawal. Do you stand with Barack or do you stand with your own plan, which you can articulate as well? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Fred wrote an article just before this week's deployment and new base announcement, an article called Iraq's Least Worst Options. And Fred, I was struck by that, the part of that article in which you said, before deciding what to do about Ramadi and the fact that ISIS has this major city now just 70 miles from Baghdad, before deciding what to do about Ramadi, the president has to decide which of the lousy, plausible outcomes sickens him the least. That was a lovely way to put it. Which of the lousy, plausible outcomes sickens him the least? Does it seem now to you, with this latest announcement, that he's made that decision?
No. What I was talking about there, you know, if you look at the politics, this is the reason why this is so hard. You know, we're all used to discussing international and regional conflicts in terms of old Cold War paradigms. You know, there's side A, which is generally with us, and side B, which is generally with them, you know, the Chinese or the Russians or whatever. This is a case where the coalition of forces that oppose ISIS, if they all got together, it would be overwhelming. But what does this include? It includes the U.S. It also includes Iran and Syria and Iraq and Turkey and Saudi Arabia. And the problem is that they don't all want to get together. Saudi Arabia views Iran with at least as much horror as they do ISIS and so forth. So my point there was actually a bit broader, was that, you know, to really crush ISIS, we're going to have to cut some kind of deal with either Iran or Bashar Assad in Syria and get the other powers in the region to go along.
So let me jump in on that, because that's one of the main dilemmas, as you put it. How much to continue our airstrikes in conjunction with the Iran-backed Shiite militias in Iraq, who are also the enemies of ISIS, as you say, and are a more effective fighting force than the actual Iraqi army. So on this program recently, I asked President Obama's former defense secretary, Robert Gates, if he thinks it's okay or a good idea for basically Iran to be our ground troops and us to be Iran's air force, and he didn't like it.
We need to work with the Iraqis, with the Iraqi government, with the Kurds, with the tribes in Anbar and the other Sunni tribes to try and push ISIS back. I think further bringing Shiite militias into predominantly Sunni areas like Anbar has a great deal of potential for abuses and for a lot of trouble in the future. I think that could be very dangerous. I think that the Sunnis will resent the Shia militias being on their turf, if you will, almost as much as ISIS.
Former Defense Secretary Gates here the other week. So Fred Kaplan from Slate, that was an interesting answer to me, because Gates's objection to partnering with the Iran-backed militias wasn't so ideologically opposed to Iran or like, ha, Iran, those people, I'm not doing business with them. He just thought the Shiite-Sunni divide is so bad there that if we empower the Shiite militias rather than marginalize them, it'll send the Sunni population, including their armed militias, running into the arms of ISIS itself, which is a Sunni organization.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's right. There's great potential for danger here. On the other hand, what's the alternative? There really is no Iraqi army right now. The Sunni militias, you know, they're the ones who ran away from Anbar when ISIS moved in with 400 troops. They need to be rebuilt, and that's part of what this new lily pad in Anbar province is all about. What do you do in the meantime? Look, was it a dangerous idea to ally with Joseph Stalin to defeat Adolf Hitler? Yeah. After the war, they took over half of Europe. What's the alternative? Better? Would it have been better not to form an alliance with Stalin and let Hitler take over the Soviet Union and Western Europe too? I mean, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
The politics is so complex that you have to decide which option makes you the least sick to your stomach.
Ross in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I have sort of two questions for your guest. One is, in the Atlantic Monthly a couple months ago, Graham Wood had an article about ISIS, and he basically asserted that ISIS is really not a threat at all to the U.S. So I'd like to know Mr. Klein's perspective. I mean, does ISIS want anything from the U.S.? Besides sort of engagement over there, are they actually a threat to us? And second of all, you played that amazing interview with Scott Walker and where he says some gobbledygook about re-engagement with forces already there. That means nothing, as you pointed out. But why don't more people in the press, when they're interviewing people like Scott Walker or Hillary Clinton, say, hey, hold on, what do you mean here? Is it because there's not an understanding of military terms? And why don't people call out Scott Walker on something like this and say, hey, what do you mean re-engagement if people are already there?
Right. Well, Jonathan Carr was trying to get at a very specific point there, which is, are you or are you not calling for deployment of more troops? And he only got them as far as he got them. I guess I have some sympathy for Jonathan Carl and the time constraints that he had on that show, that he couldn't go running down every rabbit hole of Scott Walker's inscrutable answer. However, that's why I played it here, because I could not believe what I was hearing. Over time, hopefully, those with actual access to Scott Walker, which we don't have, will call him out when they do those interviews and continue to pluck, and especially if he continues to be a very serious candidate. What exactly do you mean by this? So hopefully that will happen over time. But Ross, you're right to raise the question. Go ahead, Fred.
Well, on the first point, does ISIS constitute a direct threat to the United States? At least now they don't seem to have either the ambition or the capability to attack the United States directly. But, that's true of almost everything. If it happened that ISIS started taking over bit by bit more and more of the Middle East, then that would ultimately pose a direct threat to U.S. interests, certainly. If you had a caliphate, as ISIS leaders see it, which really did cut into Iraq and Iran and Syria, and then, I don't think they're going to take over Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Jordan, but you're going to get people in the region very nervous about this. You're going to have a region-wide war sparking, we are going to be called in to fight some position in that war.
Well, I think Ross's question, though, was, can we leave them to fight for their interests, the Saudis and the Kuwaitis and the Iranians and da-da-da? What's the direct threat to the United States? So let me move that ahead one square, because I think most Americans would agree that there is a direct threat to the United States from ISIS, at least at the level of that they've got this very sophisticated internet recruitment of lone wolves going on. And we've already seen a few Americans inspired by ISIS try to stage attacks, or actually stage little attacks like that one in Texas, where luckily he was the only person who got killed. But then I think the question from a military standpoint becomes, do we stop ISIS from inspiring Americans by going in and having a war and trying to deny them land? Is it too complicated to deny them any kind of land? Does it matter, really, if we deny them land in Iraq or land in Syria? They can still hole up in caves somewhere and inspire, the angry, radicalized Muslims of the world. And is it even relevant to the actual threat that ISIS poses to the United States to do what we're doing? I think that's the question.
Yeah, well, I think the argument that those who want us to do more make is that it's important to deny them victories. People are joining ISIS, you know, European Muslims or whatever, they're inspired by it because they see them winning. If they lost a few, that might turn back the tide. Now, in terms of who should do this, Obama's clear preference is that we do only what we are uniquely capable of doing, and that's, you know, intelligence, logistics, very precise airstrikes, that sort of thing. And he would very much prefer for Iraq, Turkey, Saudi, the powers in the region to do it themselves, and that's what this whole advise and training thing is all about, too. I think his view is, okay, yeah, the U.S. could go in with 100,000 troops and do a lot of wreckage, but then what? I mean, we already did that, and then what? Here we are. Why? Something has to change in the fundamentals of the political balance. Otherwise, this is just going to keep happening over and over and over.
One thing before you go, and we're already out of time, and we're obviously not going to solve it here today. On the can't tell the players without a scorecard, nature of the various alliances and enmities there. One rising theory that I've heard, I think mostly on the right, is that ISIS, rather than being among the insurgents trying to overthrow Assad in Syria, is actually working with Assad now in some crazy alliance. Are you familiar with that idea?
Yeah, well, you know, Assad is actually not an idiot. He's very shrewd about this. He wants to wipe out the other anti-Assad insurgents. He knows that ISIS has a rivalry with all of those, especially the ones that the United States is backing. So, yeah, he's forming an alliance with ISIS to destroy all the other insurgents. Now,
but why would ISIS be forming an alliance with him, since they started
because
as anti-Assad insurgents?
Well, because Assad has been bombing a lot of these Western-backed insurgents. It's useful for them. Assad does have lots of military force that in realms that ISIS lacks. So, in other words, yeah, just like Robert Gates said about the dangers of the United States making some kind of behind-the-scenes deal with Shiite militias, yeah, it's dangerous because what could happen? Assad could be contributing to strengthening ISIS so much that he could get overthrown himself. But he's playing what in his book is a clever game of pitting his opponents against each other, hoping to weaken all of them in the process. And then who knows if it's ISIS versus Assad, which side will the people who currently are plotting against Assad take? Mm. I mean, he's playing, in some senses, a much shrewder game than we are on this.
All right.
A more hard-boiled game.
President Obama announcing 450 more American trainers, he calls them, going to Iraq. That makes about 3,500 since the withdrawal at the end of 2011. And for the first time, an American military base to be established again in Iraq. A little clarity amid the complexity from Fred Kaplan, who writes the War Stories column for Slate, and is author of the book The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. Fred, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.